woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 450, NASDAQ futures up 23. We keep the rally going here, at least for a little bit. Walmart came out with good earnings. They say the consumer is stable. Would you say you're stable, Greg, or Luder? It's up $5. So we'll see about that. How do you like guys like being stable, Lou? You're stable.
No, I don't consider myself stable. I haven't for some time.
According to Walmart, you are stable. Despite your credit card bills going up, despite all of the automobiles that are, auto debt that is in arrears, you're stable.
I think one of the best indicators that we're looking at this, we looked at this huge inflation push on pricing of just about everything, is what is happening to insurance rates. And I say that because we just got our escrow bill for the house, and our homeowner's insurance has jumped almost 15%. Auto insurance has jumped comparable. I think I told you a couple of months ago, I scraped the side of my car dodging a pedestrian and coming out of a parking garage.
Hit him.
And well, yeah, he looked well dressed though.
God, think he was an attorney or what?
Yeah, could have been. I didn't want to take the chance. But something I would have considered basically a paint job, you know, costs thousands of dollars to repair. The insurance rates are a pretty good indicator of what it's costing or what the masters of risk assess as a potential cost. And seeing those rates skyrocket is a real marker, I think, of the kind of inflationary pressure that we're looking at on, materials and labor and things like that.
You obviously were not listening to the show yesterday, and I don't blame you necessarily, but you don't realize kind of just how wrong you are, my friend. Here's a lady with a great name. I love her saying the name. Jessica Dickler.
Okay.
Writes an article for CNBC the other day. And I'm going to put you in the 59% of Americans wrongly think the U.S. is in a recession. The report finds you just don't know how good you've got it, Lou.
Well, that's because the campaign theme, one of the professed campaign themes of the Harris campaign, to which, as far as I can tell, almost every major corporate media outlet, with the exception of Fox, is paying obeisance, is joy.
Yeah.
And cackling.
Yep.
And if we can cackle and just say joy is everywhere, we're a joyous campaign, get those negative newbies, out of here. Now we don't want to hear bad news. We only want to hear good news.
You see where you're plus your math is way off. I hate to say this because you're an attorney kind of dude. Tenants and household insurance here on the CPI over the last year is up 3.1%. What are you talking about? 15. It's right here, Lou.
Yeah. Yeah. And I trust every number coming out of the government right now, which, of course, is also in total service to the Democrats and their campaign. So any bad economic news is good, has to be blunted, or as they've been doing with the job figures for what did we figure? At least a year? Just outright lying on the initial release, correcting it a few months later when they could do it quietly.
I'm going to push back a little bit here, if you don't mind. I'm going to say that...
By the way, I need to acknowledge one of your longstanding comments. We, I think, produced more oil last month than we have ever produced in our history.
Yep. I'm saying the numbers are bigger than the president. The industry is bigger than the president. And these guys, like you just said, I'm going to agree with you, which I'm not supposed to. It's all BS. They'll come out and they'll say we're getting rid of 5 million acres of potential oil property and government lands. Nobody's wanted them for 100 years. They're in the middle of nowhere, Lou. You can say that, and you can throw a bone to the anti-oil people, and you haven't done anything, right?
Yeah, I listened to a really good podcast yesterday, as I was.
You mean better than driving. Mine? Better than ours? Not,
well, I didn't have you guys in the queue. Yesterday. This was, you're in my queue, but my player hit, my phone hit this guy. He was an oil industry analyst from a not-for-profit organization, which I don't believe there are any anymore. But anyway, he was very straight up about oil production and the other things that the government is doing, and he said the host noted this production number, and the podcaster said, "Yeah, you know, oil is just too profitable to forego production because the demands for energy are increasing and rapid." He said, "What the Biden people are doing is trying to restrict our ability to move oil and our ability to actually drill by making new environmental regulations that wave the magic ozone wand over an oil field and say, well, you're producing too much ozone."
I think, Lou, that they're actually doing everything they possibly can to sound like they're doing something when they're doing nothing.
Well, if in fact these EPA regulations go into effect, it'll have a significant impact on oil production, oil fields, currently operating oil fields. The other way they're doing it is by cutting pipelines, which he was an interesting comment. He said introducing rail transport adds an extra $10 a barrel, between $10 and $15 a barrel to the price of oil.
Well, sure.
You have to ship it by rail versus using a pipeline.
Every lock you go through in the Illinois River adds a nickel to your corn price.
I'm sure that's true. I didn't realize the impact of rail transport was that significant.
Well, I mean, how far are you talking, we'd have to take that one apart, because if you're talking about the oil from North Dakota to wherever it's going, to whatever refinery, if there isn't a pipeline,
I'm sure that's an aggregate number.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, that's one little story. That's one of the reasons why they never asked me back on CNBC. I happen to be on there. I told you the story, Lou. They wanted me on there for Walmart earnings.
You told me it was your appearance.
Oh, that wasn't so good. I looked like the room I was in. You couldn't tell where the camera was. There was no camera, and you couldn't. There was no monitor. So I didn't even know who you were talking to if you didn't realize who the people's voices were. So it was really weird. So I kept looking for where the camera might be. And Audrey goes, "You look like Tricky Dick Dixon." Your eyes kept darting back and forth like you were a cat in the alley. Gee, thanks, Aud.
My ex-wife. I was on CNN one time. During the anthrax scares, and my ex-wife called me up at work and said, I saw the CNN pork era presentation, and she said, you look really kind of puffy. And I said, well, you know, the camera supposedly adds 10 pounds. And she said, how many cameras were they using?
Well, you know, I had a guy talking about, let's not get off topic here, but I have an interesting story for you. We had a guy over from the Federal Reserve on the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve, which was, what, 2011? No, it was 14 or whatever the hell it was. When were they started? Creature from Jekyll Island or whatever, something island? Greg will find that out for us. He's good at that. And the guy comes in, and he's this really good-looking guy. He's the head of, like, whatever, the, PR for the Federal Reserve of Chicago. Little known what was so freaky about the thing, the guy looked exactly like one of my buddies from Notre Dame. I mean, you would have sworn, if you were here, that they were identical twins stolen at birth. I never saw two people look alike like that in my life. Anyway, the guy sits down. He's probably 63, 64. There's not an ounce of fat on him. He's in spectacular shape. And starts talking about the Federal. And he had an absolute encyclopedic memory of the Federal Reserve. It's a show we should probably dig out and play again someday, because it was really fascinating. The first bank of the United States, second bank of the United States. The guy knew all that stuff. And one of the Federal Reserve people was on TV, CNBC, because it was the 100th anniversary. I didn't even know it. I invited the guy. It was Christmas Eve of all times. And he goes, look at that. You can tell that guy that I'm not working out there. I should be working out there. And I go, what are you talking about? He said, look at the way he's sitting and look on his head. And I go, okay, it looks like a head to me. And he goes, you see the side the part of his hair is? He goes, you never have that part of your head facing the camera. I never even dreamed of that little. And I said, well, what if they told you that he was invited and that's where he was going to sit? He's my guy. He doesn't come on. There's more to this than meets the eye. You and I are just regular schlumps that get on TV and think we look okay.
We're just regular stumble bums. We go into the, it's a process.
Well,
process.
Get back to the insurance thing. I mean, Kevin just tweeted in that his auto up 17%. How do you, by the way, I agree with you totally that that's kind of a meter, but two quick stories. Kenny Pulcheri, who's on this week, his wife, Dan say?
Kenny, by the way, I want to talk briefly about this. Kenny just launched a tweet, I think earlier or late yesterday, on the Harris campaign announcement that they were going to somehow stop grocery prices from going up.
Okay.
So we're back to Nixon's playbook.
We have two people running for office that have zero knowledge of how this all works. Money supplies, things like that. They have no idea of it. Biden was absolutely, he's one of these new monetarists. It doesn't make any difference. Yeah, it does, Joe. And she's probably doesn't even know as much about it as he does. And Trump has no clue because during COVID, look what he did. I mean, this is scary, these two people running. Anyway, but Kenny has a, I think Dan said it's a, not a Nissan, I don't know. So it's a nice new SUV, right? So his wife gets rear-ended, and with all the sensors and all the cameras and all the other crap you got back there now, guess what the tab was? He goes, it wasn't like it was totaled or anything. Guess what the tab was to fix it?
$8,000.
$25,000.
Oh, God.
You know, probably wrecked the back hatch and who knows well. But in Audrey's area, I told you, Audrey's area has been kind of the focal point. They didn't do it, the big guy upstairs did. It was a big hailstorm that was there like a year ago. And I thought I saw pictures of her, and this wasn't a year ago, it was last spring. Her deck was like a foot deep in hailstones. It was unbelievable. I mean, you don't normally, I know in Denver you get that more often, in Orlando places, but Chicago, that's rare. Well, they've got to have 50 people in her three block area that are getting new roofs. And I'm saying the average cost of these roofs was $80,000. And I remember when my parents had their house, like every roof, it was like $1,200. Put another layer of asphalt down there and away you went, right? Not anymore. I mean, I don't know which comes first, the chicken or the egg, but on the insurance stuff. But I think those guys are, I mean, any like you say, any kind of a and these auto body shops are jammed because everybody's keeping every car till it's 100 years old, me included. I mean, I don't know where you come with this, but I mean, you look at the Walmart article or thing we started earlier. My, you know, having been through this in the 70s and 80s with the inflation and actually studying it in school, and then being the inflation guy at Pullman and other places, I mean, I have a, and of all the things in the world, I probably know more about than most people. It's what happens in inflation. I'm not happy I know that at all, but it just so happens I do. It's like you know military law better than anybody because you happen to be there, right? And everybody else thinks they know it, but they don't because you do. You were there, and my worst fears were whenever you have this concentration in industries, the Walmarts, the Home Depots of the world, those kinds of people. As they pick off company after company. Now, Mars just bought another company yesterday. They're going to be the only candy producer in the world, it appears. They don't even know the power they have until all of a sudden one day they wake up and they go, wow, look at all this inflation. The stuff's coming to us up 8%. You know what? We can up it 12%. We're ahead of the deal. Don't anybody ever think that anybody with any monopoly power is not a big winner during inflation? They are. If you and I are a barbershop, we're competitive. We're not a winner, Lou. We're probably losing. Our gas bill is going up faster than the cost of the haircuts. These people, once you have any kind of monopoly power, that never happens to you. And all of a sudden, you get bigger and bigger and bigger at it. And I'm not being standing on a soapbox here. I'm just telling you that's the truth because this is what I know about and I know it. Just saying. How's that for a rant?
No, I don't disagree with that. I look at these, as I said, I just look at these numbers and just roll my eyes and say, this is what the economy has been driven to. And we don't have great choices, but we have an electorate, and this goes back to something we talked about, I think, last week. We have an electorate that seems to be getting dumber. With respect to things like economics, that I got a very basic, economics course or very basic economics syllabus when I was in high school. It was part of my civics program, and this is how the Federal Reserve works. This is what here, at least in theory, and these are inflationary drivers. This is what money supply does. Just a basic. Supply, demand, and how we try to regulate it. I'm pretty sure they're not teaching that anymore.
No, or people aren't learning it, or something.
Otherwise, you would not see the appeal of a populist president. In part, is based on giving people what they want, and that. The people seem to want stupid stuff. bread and circuses, by the way, I used that reference the other day with one of our associates who's I think just turned 30, and he actually recognized it. He said Rome, right? I said yeah, which goes back to a topic you and I have talked about. And that is that as men, and Greg, we're all in this together, as men, we think about the Roman Empire at least once a day.
Well, yeah.
I think that's a great line. I think as guys, we should think about the Roman Empire at least once a day.
Well, it depends on, I every time I think about the word inflation pops into my head. If I got stuck with 4 years of Latin a little, because I was so horrible.
Before you go into the Latin...
Yep.
Lou, what was the result of that? I think it was the military three-star or the Marine three-star general who took on. It was like a war game or something. His job was to defeat the Empire. This was, and supposedly like his plan sunk the carrier group in the Persian Gulf or something. But nobody ever listened, so nothing changed.
Well, he's not the... Yeah.
Not anymore, but about. Like the whole point was to figure out how a little guy can beat the big guy. They put this like Marine three-star general
Because unlike other services, the Marines are masters at gaming systems, you know, that they know well, and I mean in the Marine Corps he would have been promoted. The Navy, I'm sure, wasn't thrilled that this guy had turned the tables on him. But I don't think there. I mean, there were no official repercussions for him. I mean, internally in the Marines, the guy would have been a hero, you know, because making the Navy look bad is, you know, part of
supposedly the Marine Corps, instead of doing electronic communications and stuff, he disguised his communications inside like the prayer calls and used like motorcycle carriers to transmit messages and stuff, and the Navy was listening and they weren't finding anything, and then all of a sudden their carrier group was sunk.
Yeah, the coordinated attack.
And
yeah,
how did they do it with like the same type of like crappy boats and stuff that just rigged with explosives?
It's, you know, those kinds of exercises are invaluable. Now whether we actually learned anything from it, I don't know. There is a very well-developed wargaming group in the Pentagon that plays the stuff out, these scenarios out, all the time. The issue, and I'm sorry to say this, is that, you know, we know exactly how to deal with, say, the Houthis. We know that, you know, they're pirates. We know exactly how to deal with them. Our leadership is not willing to, you know, that for whatever reason. So, I think that guy was probably fated at every Marine Corps function for the rest of his career. I'm sure the Navy, you know, the Navy flatlined him at a 3-star. What's interesting is that in the Marine, a guy like that gets promoted in the Marine Corps. Pretty much everywhere else, he's not going to get promoted above Colonel.
Lou, who's the dude who, in some kind of war games exercise, actually planned out the Pearl Harbor attack? You come from the Northwest, you come on a Sunday
here
morning.
Here it is. It's called the Millennium Challenge, MC-02.
Okay.
Mandated by Congress. And they gave the constraints, the exercise action, and then aftermath. It turned from an honest, open, free play test of warfighting into a rigidly controlled and scripted exercise.
Well, who was that guy who essentially wrote the plan for Pearl Harbor that the general used?
Mitchell, you know, Billy Mitchell, the air power pioneer, wrote a paper, and this actually came up at his trial. He was court-martialed. Wrote a paper saying, we're going to get attacked at Pearl Harbor. Now, I can't remember the naval officer who said this is how they're going to do it, but Mitchell was court-martialed in the late 20s, I think.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, we're going to get hit. Where's the strike going to fall? It's going to fall at Pearl Harbor.
Well, whoever the dude was had the Sunday morning part, what direction you came from. Well, mm-hmm. everything it was totally scripted by us. And they did.
By the way, Greg, going back to your story about the war game, that scripted stuff is what the Russians have been doing apparently for decades. And it's one of the reasons that their operations fell apart in Ukraine. We had been reading, Russophiles like myself had been following Soviet or Russian military developments after the fall of the Soviet Union. And one of the things that we watched were their large-scale joint force, you know, combined arms exercises that they would run, you know, two, three times a year. So this, you know, these were huge. They involved aircraft, they involved tanks, they involved helicopters, low earth aviation, heavy artillery, the whole bit. And we watched these things, and we said these guys, you know, they are practicing what they preach, because the Soviet doctrine from the 1970s and 80s emphasized the use of combined arms attacks. What we did not understand was that every one of these exercises was rigidly scripted. You know, okay, you know, these five tanks are now going to move in this direction and feint you know, and everybody understands that's where it's going. There was absolutely no flexibility, no improvisation, no nothing. It was all done according to a script, like you would expect a central planning group to do. And so when you take forces that have had nothing but scripted exercises and you throw them into combat, which of course is totally unscripted, where the enemy gets a vote, they fall apart. And that's what happened. Now that the Russians have gotten a lot better at it, but they, one of the things we noted was their total inability to fly airplanes into the forward areas of their combat arena, you know, in groups of more than two or three. And we talked about this at the time, how difficult it is to coordinate air power when you've got artillery shells going through the area that the jets are flying. And the fact that, you know, you have to deconflict all these, you know, all this airspace. And the Russians couldn't do it. And we were wondering, you know, for the first 6 months, what the heck was going on? Did they have some kind of technical glitch or whatever that was preventing them from running their operations plans? And the assessment finally was, it's not that they won't do it, it's that they can't do it. They don't have the skill sets to do it.
We'll come back from break.
This kind of stuff.
Well, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. I want to dig into it a little bit, what you guys are talking about, you know, the current administration and the numbers coming out of Washington, but also you're a man to fill us in on what's going on in Ukraine with this end around.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it was on my list too.
S&P futures up 12, NASDAQ futures up 59. Be right back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen. We got Greg Pappas in the studio. Lou Michaels with us. Hey, how come this isn't one of you two gentlemen? Starbucks is giving incoming CEO Brian Nickel $85 million in cash. I can manage for you. Everybody be happy. $85 million to walk in the door. What if the guy's a putz?
He's not a putz. He's actually pretty good.
Well, we'll find out.
They already tried to find out.
Just because you're good at one place doesn't mean you're good at another place.
Yeah, he's been good at two places.
All right, so he deserves the 85.
Probably more than that.
All right, well, there you go. And so that's what happens. That's what these new guys.
Did you see what happened in their stock when they announced it?
Well, that's all hype. I mean, how would you like to be the CEO to get removed and your stock went up 20%? That'd be a bad day. Oops. Your wife said, gee, I thought you said you were doing a good job. Dow futures up 113. Over in Europe, we got the DAX up 65.4%. FTSE up 10.1%. CAC around up 58 cents. Call that flat. So up a little bit in Europe. In Asia, Nikkei up 284.8%, 36,726. Hang Seng down 4, call that flat. Shanghai up 26. Wow, they're actually up. That's 0.9%, 28.77, trying to scrape back to 2,900. They've been in a funk, the mainland China stocks. Bonds up 2 basis points, 3.85. The Bund up 2 basis points, 2.2. Japan up 3 basis points, 0.84. So interest rates are sneaking up here. Oil up 76 cents, 77.74. Kind of creep back in the middle of the range. Brent up 71 cents, 80.47. Natural gas up 3 cents, 2.25. Arbob a penny, 2.34. Gold with a nice rally here, 16.60. That's if you're long gold. 0.7%, 40. $24.96, trying to creep back over $2,500. Silver up 84 cents, 3%. $28.18. You know, if all I did, Greg, for my clients in the last year or 2 years would have been to buy silver under 26 and sell it over 29 or 30, it would have been an unbelievable year. How many times does this thing yank back and forth within that range violently and it never breaks out? It's crazy. Copper up 7 cents, 4.11. We've got Bitcoin down 282, 58,668. Foreign exchange, which has been the thing to watch lately. Euro 1.10, so the dollar's down a little bit. British pound is at 128.6, so about unchanged. And the yen now has been pretty steady in the mid-147s here. So after the big move from 63 down to up to 63 and then down to 43, it seems to have steadied out here at 147. Yesterday, as a way of review, Dow up 242, S&P up 20, NASDAQ only up 4. So the NASDAQ was the leader the day before. Yesterday, not so much the leader, but still up. Reinforced traffic, weather, sports, Cubs. Ouch.
Morning, everyone. It is 6:36 here in Chicago. We have 75 and breezy, intermediate heavy rain today. So slow travel and reduced visibility. Phoenix 88 right now, high of 110 today. We got heat and air quality warning in Phoenix. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 28 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 50 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is 27 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, 22 minutes. And the Stevenson 294 to the Ryan is 28 minutes. Baseball, Diamondbacks win at home against the Rockies. That was 11-4. Cubs lose to Guardians in Cleveland, 1-6. Ouch. And, of course, White Sox lose again. Yankees win 10-2. However, Aaron Judge set a record. He became the fastest player to hit 300 home runs in MLB history. So, that's all I got, Chief.
Which is pretty good considering the guy was hurt a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, he's quite the player. Louis, a question for you on the numbers. I mean, I think we have agreement across pretty much everybody on Stocks and Jacks that evidently the Biden administration has released price of 10 drugs in Medicare negotiations. U.S. will save $6 billion a year, first year. Anyway, somewhere along and buried in this office, there's a piece of paper where somebody traced virtually every president, I'm going to say starting with Kennedy, maybe even Eisenhower, maybe not everyone, but along the way, how people have tweaked the numbers that people get. It used to be that Social Security, when it was a surplus, was part of the regular budget, and then it wasn't. And everybody has done a little bit of something to change the numbers to make them look better. Not everybody. And this CPI stuff, when I was doing this work in the late 70s, it was pretty believable. And I'm going to say, at least since 2000, we've had a lot of presidents since 2000, it's become non-believable, mostly because of the medical piece. Now, lately, because of the insurance piece and the housing piece on top of that. But it I don't know if it's the, you know, Biden making the call to the guy doing it and saying adjust it back. I don't know that that's happening. I don't know if people just put their finger to the wind and see which way the wind is coming. Remember that line in the Casablanca? I put my finger to the wind and the political winds are coming from Vichy, Claude Rains. Or they get so far behind where they're, you know, 20%, 30% behind on medical expenses and housing and everything that they just can't even find a way to do the adjustment and bring it current. Or something, somewhere in that mix of crap is the problem and maybe a solution, or maybe there is no solution. I don't know that they did anything more for this guy in CPI numbers than they did for Trump, or they did for Obama, or they did for Bush. I think somewhere along the line, it just started and just keeps going. And once you do it, I mean, I don't know if somebody, who's got the stones, whoever the new administration is, and the BLS to say, you know, I'm tired of putting this piece of crap out where the medical expenses are 6.5% when they're really 20, and next month they're 20, and all of a sudden we're shocked. Has anybody got the balls to do that? I mean, or anybody want to do that? I mean, a million questions.
We've talked about this. There has to be, and this goes again to our issue of transparency. I think there would be pressure to get this kind of information out, this accurate information out, if we had more transparency about how the numbers were being generated, but we don't. And we don't find, I mean, when you have your mainstream press in complete service to one party, you're not going to get the kind of public pressure that causes these kinds of things to turn. The reason the executive agencies do this is to curry favor with the elected leadership, and to promote a particular ideological worldview. And unless there is wholesale attention focused on, for example, how the Department of Labor calculates employment rates, and how they discount, you know, or hide the figures on the number of people who aren't seeking work, the misjiggering on this stuff, you know, if it would be a scandal if there was consistent reporting about how the labor numbers, which is what I pay a lot of attention to, are reset every few months, you know, retroactively, because it's clear what's happening.
Well, sometimes they adjust them the other way. Not often, but sometimes.
No. No, but my point is, the point that I'm making is that the readjustments are happening, you know, as a matter of course. So you throw that out there to show that whatever methodologies we're using are obviously flawed. Why do we keep correcting it? What's wrong with the algorithm that we have to keep correcting it?
Well, let's save this for another show, because I want to talk more about this UK. But Louis, if we were to, you and I were to design this,
we're dealing with people who, when it looked like Obama was you know, in the middle of a, or when Biden was in the middle of a recession starting, three or four years ago, the online dictionaries all went out and changed the definition of recession.
Well, now you have your own definition now. That's, everybody can have their own. There is none.
This is the kind of thing you're up against with respect to this data. When the vaccine, the COVID vaccine, was demonstrably ineffective at preventing transmission, CDC went online and changed their working definitions of what a vaccine was.
Without a doubt.
And so this is the mentality you're dealing with, and unless you get more a corporate media that is in thrall to one party only, you're not going to get the kind of public
this. Who's you'll remember this? Who's the lady? Came on the, well, she came on twice. The real terrific. She's a news lady out of Washington. What the hell is her name, Lou? You remember her because you were on with her. Maddie got her. What the hell was her name?
Cheryl Atkinson.
Yeah, Cheryl Atkinson.
Yeah,
she was spectacular, and I asked her.
She still is.
Well, I didn't say she. I didn't mean to imply that there was anything wrong with her now, but I said, how come when people go to the press conferences for the for the Powell or at the time Bernanke, whoever, why do they ask like these really dumb questions? And you know, she was very articulate. Well, she is very articulate. And she said, you know, two reasons. One is you don't necessarily want to do something that won't get you invited back. But she goes, to be perfectly blunt, and I'll tell you what, I was so impressed with her. She went, before she came on, Lou, she listened to about four or five shows to see the kind of hairpin she was dealing with, meaning me. And she goes, you know, Tom, I've listened to your shows. They're not you. They have no idea what you're talking about. They come out of some journalism school. They're not about, do they actually know what the money supply is or does, like you know? They're not going to ask that question. A, they don't want to, and B, they don't know to ask it. Now, I don't know how much of which is which.
I think the former dominates the latter. They don't want to. Washington Post, Tom, you had a Washington Post reporter ask the White House press secretary 2 days ago, isn't there some way you guys can shut down this Elon Musk Trump discussion on Twitter? I mean, sir, ask that question.
Well, it's the same.
Seriously,
it's the same as Musk thinking he has zero rules of any sort of. What is he now? Is he a newspaper? Is he a radio station? He seems to want to be without any of the rules that go with it.
He's something different, but he's a private citizen.
The
idea that you would have a member of the Fourth Estate asking the executive branch, can you guys figure out a way to shut down Free speech.
I don't agree with that. As you know, I don't agree with that either. But I could, if I all of a sudden jump my butt and all of our butts on a big time radio station, and I interviewed Trump, and all of a sudden somebody said, well, now you got to interview Harris, and I said, no, I'm a private citizen. I don't have to do that. Lou, that's BS. In one area, there's rules. You have to do that. And
well, first of all, he offered Harris an opportunity to do exactly the same thing, and she turned it down.
So
he's your argument that he's somehow being unfair is
well, I mean, he's going to be the only interviewer from the other side. That's an unfair. If I'm her, I say no too. Why would I want to talk to that guy?
Okay, well, that's your call. He's as far as I'm concerned, he's extended.
He's not even required to do this. In my opinion, he's jealous of the other idiot owning the Washington Post. The idea that these big guys with all this money now are controlling our on either side, I find appalling. And part of it is, you and I are too cheap to buy a newspaper anymore.
Let me. Well, Tom, have you looked at newspapers lately? They're worthless.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? They can't hire reporters because
nobody. I would say the ideological takeover of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Trib, the LA Times, the Minneapolis Star Tribune has been ongoing for decades, and it's much like NPR. I stopped listening to NPR in the 90s.
Lou,
because it became too one-sided.
You didn't grow up in Chicago, thank God, probably for a lot of reasons there, but Lou, we had four newspapers. You couldn't get an ideological. No newspaper was ever more ideological than the guy who ran the Tribune. Damn, the guy should have gone to jail for the stuff he used to publish against Roosevelt, leaking out war secrets and stuff. Yet we had three other newspapers. Nobody cared. The other newspapers checked the guy. We didn't have the government to do it. The press did it because people bought all four papers. I don't know which is first. Nobody wants to pay for any news, and they bitch there's no news. I'm not accusing you of that, by the way.
Well, no, I know. But my point is, or to go back to where we were,
yeah.
Elon Musk is a guy who has control over a social media company, and he's doing exactly the same thing, only he's doing it on the open, that Mark Zuckerberg did in 2020 with his Zuckbucks funding below the waterline malfeasance with how elections were being run. Admittedly, it's a problem. But in this case, at least, you got a billionaire who said, "I want to do it," even-handedly, and tried to.
Well, you don't know. You never knew the man, I don't think. My buddy and the head of Mesro, Jimmy Tyree, with money, he saved my high school. When the Sun-Times went down, with all the mess with Hollinger and all those other guys, he got together a group of people and he said, "No, Chicago has to have two newspapers. You got to have somebody who's independent, and you got to have some sort of something to go against the Tribune and whoever else." And you know what? It's still published. You would think that regular people would say, "You know what? No matter what, I'm going to get the Sun-Times delivered for, $10 a month. I want another newspaper." Nobody cares, Lou. Nobody cares. They think they get everything they want from whatever they feel like listening to, either on cable or the internet. And you know what? They're not getting it. They don't want it. You think the people that listen to Fox or CNBC all day long are willing to fund somebody to actually give real news? They want affirmation. They don't want information.
Well,
I'm going to go ahead and say that's how it's always been. And that's how it always will continue to be.
It's always been that way.
Since
which part are you disagreeing about? I'm saying there were all Pulitzer. Kinds of independent newspapers. There were independent.
Tom, in the 1960s, I agree with Greg. In the 1960s, the media diet that was fed to the American people was rigidly controlled out of New York. And to a lesser extent, Washington D.C.
Well, it sure wasn't in Chicago. We had an independent station at WGN, and we had three independent newspapers that wouldn't count.
They weren't reaching. I mean, Walter Cronkite had the same editorial worldview as the editors of the New York Times, who had the same editorial worldview as the editors of the Washington Post. Now they may have been slightly more balanced in their worldview. But what we saw on the in the press was rigidly controlled, and rigidly managed. And I think I agree with Greg. One of the things that's been noteworthy about, I'm sorry, newspapers can't keep up. They didn't keep up.
Well, the Daily News had a foreign service. They had people over in World War II. Nobody would support that now.
In any event, the rise of this independent media, such as Twitter, is the only way that you're getting any kind of alternative presentation on most of the issues that are of concern to you and me. And that's not because of Elon Musk. That's because of the people who are on Twitter. He's not regulating that content. And that's why
he wants to.
Well, I mean I know that some of the algorithm that there have been people who've had some stuff, you know, demonetized on Twitter, but it's not like, for example, YouTube or some of the Google stuff that's happening. He's allowed a wide range of stuff on there. And if you don't believe me, just go on.
Right. So we're saying that he's a more benevolent dictator than whoever runs Google.
I'm not saying he's a dictator. I'm saying he's more of a free market guy. So he just lets the stuff come on.
I don't want him or the guy in Google in charge of the news.
Well, who do you want? You want the guy in the
EU?
Who sends the letter to Elon Musk saying, I want you to shut down this
I actually think that if people, I'm, as you know, I'm a free market guy. If people want free stuff, they should be able, I should be paying for the London Times. I should be paying for those kinds of places, I think, that are more, that still have real news. You know, I actually used to love reading. Before they went out, was Al Jazeera, U.S.,
Yeah, they give you an interesting perspective. I look at their stuff.
But now they're not here anymore. Anyway, hey, what's going on? Ukraine.
You can follow them online.
No, they're gone. U.S. They folded.
Well, Al Jazeera regulars, you can follow.
Yeah, I know. I never get into that one too much. But the one in the U.S. actually had U.S. news. I thought they were pretty good. Anyway, Lou, Ukraine, this a game changer?
No, but it is a leverage point. So. My look at this is that this invasion does a number of things, but one of the things it does, and you mentioned this last week, it shows that when you get a chance to run NATO's game plan against unfixed fortifications, and by the way, NATO's game plan was you don't attack fixed defenses, you go around them and cut them off. When you get a chance to see NATO's operational warfare plan and actually being executed, it works. It can work with even in circumstances where you have relatively small units running. That's one thing. The next thing it does is it dramatically weakens the Russian government in terms of its perceptions with its people.
Didn't they have to pull a couple of divisions out of their other offensive, though, to come chase these guys?
Well, it's a zero-sum game, obviously, where you put, you don't have unlimited manpower, so where you put one group, you're not reinforcing another. But their perception is we will trade some limited ground for in the south of the combat area for significant gains in the north. And so they're sticking a finger in the eye of Vladimir Putin by doing this. They are forcing the Russians to get out of their comfort zone and just, you know, throwing human wave attacks against Ukrainian positions after massive artillery bombardment. The way the Ukrainians are moving on this front, you know, the Russians have to move forces to come in to try to, you know, blunt the advance. Every time they put a bunch of people, more than, you know, three or four trucks together to move troops in, they're subject to an attack, and that's already happened once, where the estimates are that the Ukrainians killed, you know, 400 or 500 Russian troops in one attack on a convoy. So this multiplies the difficulty for the Russians. It now appears that they've somehow captured a rail node, not somehow, but they captured a rail node that had the switching and rail control information points for the entire Russian system, and that by capturing this node, the Ukrainians are able to compromise rail shipments throughout most of Western Russia.
For the whole country? This
is the Western part of the country, yes. And this is creating havoc for the Russians. The articles I read on Telegram talk about how rail shipments are starting to shut down across the western part of Russia because they can't schedule things properly. They can't deconflict tracks because this node that the Ukrainians captured has access to all that information.
It sounds like CrowdStrike.
Yeah, actually it does. but you've got this psychological effect, a strategic effect that is definitely affecting the ability of the Russians to move forces in that area. You're creating all kinds of logistical problems for the Russians, who are not a group that have done logistics well. The Russians have apparently just ordered the evacuation of 200,000 people from around the Kursk area. You know, when they say order the evacuations, it's not like the Russians have moved a bunch of buses up there to move these people. These are people walking out of major cities in Russia.
The history of this somewhere, I mean, I know back in my younger days, Russians were in Afghanistan almost as long as we were. They were like 10 years, right? And they were basically getting their ass kicked. And, I don't know if that's the right term, but somewhere, some way, even with their totalitarian regime, somebody somewhere said, enough of this, and they ended up pulling out of there, and I think there was some sort of a regime change. And at what point does this Ukraine thing become... I mean, Russian people are people. They can't like husbands and sons being killed every friggin' day over a place they never even heard of or they don't care about. I mean, somewhere, someplace, is this going to become a drag on these guys to where there's going to be a regime change and they're going to be a pullout like Afghanistan?
Not for a while.
But what was the trigger in Afghanistan? Why it was on a Tuesday and not a Monday?
The trigger in Afghanistan, there was no single event. It was a long-term assessment and changeover in Soviet leadership from Chernenko to where, you know, the stand-in through Andropov, who was going to be the guy that probably would have orchestrated the switchover. Actually, it was Andropov first, then Chernenko, then Gorbachev, who comes in. He's a student of Andropov. He says, okay, I understand what's happening. We're bleeding. We're bleeding here to no avail. The Russians have but Ukraine is different. You know, Afghanistan was a separate country. The Russians don't look at Ukraine as a separate country. They look at it as they look at these people as a bunch of traitors and a breakaway state, a part of Russia. As Putin said, Ukraine as a country does not exist and never has. They view this as bringing in an entity, a region that rightfully is theirs. So there may be some pressure on Putin from, you know, internal to, you know, eliminate this black eye. But this is a very small, in the big scheme of things, this is a very small incursion. The Ukrainians do not have the manpower, the trained manpower, to exploit it well beyond the boundaries that they've established now. They are still moving forward. They are still working to envelop some areas, but you know, they do not have the manpower to hold that region. And if the Russians decide,
are they encircling? I mean, World War II, the Germans never had near as big an army as France. They just encircled them and screwed them over.
Well. The encirclement, the Ukrainians are in danger of being encircled because they need to expand the front. You know, can't, they've got a salient going into Russia right now. That salient can be cut off, just like the Kursk salient was cut off during World War II.
Okay.
So they have to be careful. They have to expand the base so that the Russians cannot mobilize a force large enough to come in from the south and cut that incursion off.
So they both were. By the way, who is Lauren Boebert? I got this text. Some lady here, she's screaming.
The congresswoman?
She goes, under Tim Walz, Detroit has the highest murder rate in Minnesota. Okay. This is what happens when you don't finish high school. I don't think Detroit's in Minnesota, is it?
Is this something Lauren?
Evidently she's being attributed to this quote.
She's a congresswoman. She's an ideologue. She's a restaurant owner here in Colorado. She's hot.
She's the one who switched districts to run, right?
Yes, and was, you know, I mean, she's loud and brassy and
she red attractive. Or red or green or red or blue.
She's a Republican.
Oh, okay, I didn't know which one.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, she's said a variety of kind of dumb things, but I mean, she's right. I wouldn't put her in the dumbness category of Marjorie Taylor Greene, but I would. She's not a intellectual.
But they get elected. This is the world. Everybody thinks that these are the people that should represent them.
She got elected because, much like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez got elected, she was attractive, she was energetic, she was dogmatic, and she said things that a lot of people wanted said.
Are we going to come out of this okay, you think? Are we going to try? I was having an adult beverage at my gang last night, and there's a table of 12 young people. This is over at your place, Greg. And one of the guys, of course, they have the social grace of a wildebeest, right? They all sit down, and they're going to go to the bar and get their own drinks, which is, of course, a no-no. You got a waiter, right? So they don't allow that. So they get carded, and one guy drops his driver's license, right? So just laying there. So the waiter is a terrific guy. Comes by, and I go, hey, you know, tell that knucklehead his driver's license is on the ground. So the waiter picks it up and hands it to the guy. The guy gives him a harumph look, not even a thank you. And he goes, the difference between older people and younger people and just in their common courtesy, he goes, do these kids learn their common courtesy by phone or what? I mean, these are the people that are electing these people. They just say some crazy stuff and all of a sudden they should be president or something. I mean, I don't get it, Lou. I mean, when I was on the board of the SIBO, we'd have these meetings once in a while. You know, it was a pretty democratic organization. And somebody who was, you know, actually pretty bright would stand up and say something at one of these meetings. And they and you know, maybe it was pretty halfway intelligent. And somebody would say, that guy should be on the board. And I go, no, he shouldn't. And they go, what do you mean he shouldn't? I said, I've known the guy for 20 years. The door's never hit him in the ass at 320. Being these people, being a representative, being a senator, really is kind of a lot of work. And people who don't do any work got no business in that job, Blue. I don't think, but it's not just, how can I put it nicely? The skill set to get into the job is not the skill set you want in the job. And it's probably the same thing in the Oval Office these days, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure what the skill set is to get into the Oval Office.
Well, it's the catch fire with people. I mean, Trump has caught fire to people. His thing is he doesn't like Washington, and most people don't like Washington. And they see him as the only guy that's their fighter against this incestuous whatever the hell it is out there that seems to be this bureaucratic state we now have.
I'm going to let Dan on.
All right.
I want you to note that the Biden White House finally released the documents showing Hunter soliciting State Department officials while his dad was the VP on behalf of Burisma and a couple of other entities. Obviously, for money.
I know people who knew the guy when they were 20 years ago. He was a sleazeball then. He's always a sleazeball.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right. I mean, but this formally establishes the links between influence.
He's formally a sleazeball?
Pardon me?
He's formally a sleazeball?
No, this just formalizes it.
All right.
All right.
Take care of yourself, buddy. Talk at you next week. SV Futures up 12, NASDAQ Futures up 50. We're going to go. What do you say? We go right to Dan. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm great. How are you?
All right. Did you enjoy your geography lesson of Russia and Ukraine and all that? It's pretty, you know, I think it's something that as traders we should kind of keep our eye on all this stuff. I don't know what you do about it, but I think it's something we should at least be aware of. It's not tradable, I don't think, but it's something, whatever that means.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in terms of not tradable, I would myself at the camp of those investors who lean on the conservative side and really want to see more information before making a decision like that.
Yeah, I know. Well, you've had a chance to sit back and look at the entire flip from a week ago Monday to today, and all the commentary on TV and all the other stuff, and just keep buying the big caps. There's no top. Proven once again that once they go down, money comes from somewhere, and all of a sudden they come flying back up, and
yeah.
And here you are. And thank God we didn't get caught in any calls or anything. We actually negotiated this very well. You could have got caught pretty easy when you start talking about 10-15 strikes in 2-3 days. I mean, that's kind of a lot. We've got the metals still creeping up. We've got the interest rates coming back up a little bit, which you would think they wouldn't be now that everybody thinks the Fed's going to cut. They're actually kind of going the other way since that announcement, right? Kind of an odd world, which is, how, what are you making of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're actually, I don't agree with everything you said. I do think rates are coming down a little bit in anticipation of the September cut.
I was talking about 10-year.
On the 10-year, yeah. But I think there's still a lot of money in the system. You know, we've been talking about, coming back into this sort of normal range when it comes to unemployment and CPI now coming down to 2.9 as of earlier this week. That really can only be viewed as a positive, although I think the market has taken it in several different ways. The one thing that really concerns me is that people are talking about a recession possibility because CPI has come down. And just as the average person going to the grocery store or going out to dinner or having the electrician come by to fix, you know, something in your house, or a contractor, or going and having a medical experience like the dentist that I went to yesterday, I don't see inflation coming down.
No.
I mean, I see prices still quite high, and I hear that same thing from pretty much everybody across various walks of life and various industries. So as we've spoken before, some of that data seems to be massaged, or they seem to be taking certain data and drawing attention to it. There is a lot of money in the system still. There's a lot of money in the system. There's lots of people in getting huge inheritances. There's lots of people retiring, selling their businesses. There's a lot of people who've earned a lot of money, not only in the equity markets, but also in their housing. So that money is coming back into the system. What that is the sort of the positive force, if you will. The negative force that's causing this volatility is just, I think, the concern mostly that there could be some major slowdown, which that we are not in that camp at all. There could be, you know, because of the accelerated pace that we're seeing the CPI numbers come down, and they say unexpectedly. I don't agree with that, but there, you know, certainly we are seeing things moving in the right direction, and there are people who are going to the other extreme and saying, is this too much? So what's that created has been a lot of volatility in the market in the last few weeks, which I do not believe will change between now and the election. So I think, you know, you can make some money trading this volatility. You guys can make it easily. I can make it also. But I would not leave. I would leave that up to a professional investor like us. And as a day trader, I would stay away unless it's just maybe 5% of your portfolio. This is a time that really matters for those investors like us who have a lot of experience trading the market. Because the volatility, you can really get whipsawed. And I've had a couple of experiences recently with a couple of clients who don't have a strong stomach. We're basically saying, that we put a little equity in that account last week and it's down and I've lost money. I don't really want to lose money. So what happens there is you end up selling something at a time when you shouldn't. Because if you are going to participate in this volatility, you need to be protected. You also need to know that your time horizon, you have to understand your time horizon. So if it's a quick flip, that's one thing. If you're in it for the long run, you're going to have to be watching it day to day.
That's not today's world. People hire a manager, they stare at it all day long, and they call the manager up and complain.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's It's part of the today's world, but it's not the whole picture.
No, it's not the whole picture. And they're also, I mean, I'm not, sounds like I'm denigrating clients. I'm not. I mean, but I do work for several places, and some of the clients are, I mean, you wonder why they hire somebody, because all they do is stare at it all day. I mean, it's like my mother, after years and years, Dan, finally hired a cleaning lady, right? So I take her out to breakfast. She goes, well, we got to hustle back because the cleaning lady's coming over. And I go, well, isn't that the idea? You can come to breakfast while she cleans the house. Oh, no, I got to watch her. Ma'am, you're unclear on the concept a little bit here. But anyway, I was not about to change her mind. You know how that works. But, you wonder what it's all about. But, Dan, sometimes the retail mantra, and my brother says it, is we've been through ups and downs, you know, the years we've been here and with the market. And people generally don't sell when things are going up. They sell when things are going down, because they're, if you start out your account, say, with $1 million and you want to be aggressive, you don't want any protection or anything, you can probably still have a comfortable retirement, say, I'm going back a few years on the numbers have probably changed now, but if you had $800,000, you're probably still okay. All right, so if you put your money in the market and you don't have any protection, you don't have anybody like me or you helping, and all of a sudden it runs down to $800,000, which it has on a million occasions, and even now we don't think that'll happen because the Fed's going to pop it back up, which in recent history is probably true, but it's not all history. If it goes down to $800,000, people say, it can't go any further because I'm okay here, but if it's at six, I got a real problem. So you set yourself up to be a seller at 800 on day one, right? Because you can only lose 200. So instead of being, you know, protected out of the 200 you maybe should have lost, you only lose 20 or 25 or 30 or something, because you're never going to protect anybody the whole way. You still got 970, and you could be a buyer protected at 800, but you, because you don't have any protection, you can't be. So you're selling. That's why people sell. I mean, sometimes the retail mantra is we buy when it's going up and we sell when it's going down, and you really want the other side of that trade, correct?
Yeah.
But the reason why you're stuck selling on the way down is because you never sell. I mean, how many people, this is going to sound like it's funny, but it's not. How many people, when NVIDIA traded under 100 last week? Last week. We're not talking about last year, last decade, last week. How many people put their eyes up to the heavens and said, I promise, if this thing ever goes back to 110, I'll lighten up, or 115. Just please, God, give me one more chance. Well, here it is at 117. I'm going to say not one of those people sold one share.
So I agree with you on that. Totally agree with you on that. And that in itself really is the problem. That's where the greed kicks in, and you know, you're kind of playing with fire a little. I think that you're going to get stuck with this trade in the volatility, and it's going to work a few times, and then there's going to be a time where it just keeps going down, or just keeps going up, depending on which side of that trade you're on. But it's not really a solid way to make money for long-term investors. It's a good way to make money if you're looking just at the short term, and if your time horizon is very short. But I had a couple clients making comments like, well, I want to make sure that I get back to the level where I was at before we do anything else. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's an odd, you know, goal, because
you can understand it. You can understand it. I'd like to be even before I get out.
Right. But it's a strange goal, because it may or may not get there. And then in the meantime, there could be an opportunity cost to be an investor in something else that actually has a better upside potential and more diversification. But there is an issue that you bring up, I think, that's important in terms of understanding. And I have had several questions this past week from clients trying to understand the relationship between the metals, like gold and silver, for example, and some other, and the equity markets and rates. And it isn't a simple formula, and it changes based on what's going on. There's a lot of different factors that influence the price of gold, the price of silver, the price of oil. And those can change. So you really can't have a formula for how much that's going to work. You have to consider that these commodities trade on a different business cycle. they trade, if you were to graph out the performance of gold, silver, oil, and other commodities, and look at their graphs compared to, say, S&P 500 or treasuries or the general economy or CPI, it's not going to always, they're not going to be in lockstep or reverse lockstep all the time. There are too many factors that have an influence, and you really do have to pay attention to each of these commodities. Each of these markets is going to trade differently. The relationship between these markets is something that's always fascinated me, but I also realize that this is a dynamic process. It's not a static process. These relationships between, say, CPI and interest rates or stock, even just stocks and bonds, is not static. It changes from time to time based on a whole lot of other factors, a host of other factors. And we have many of those other factors taking place right now. While we have some things that are good, like lower mortgage rates, you know, rates coming down to 6.5%. We're seeing refinancing pick up. So lower rates are helping. They're also helping equities, you know, the stocks, companies that want to refinance, that are waiting for levels to get a little bit lower. They want to get their cost of capital back in line, and they're able to do that. So interest rates coming down can be and should be a good thing, but not in all cases.
Well, I think
one of the misconceptions, Chief, is that people seem to think with rates coming down, that means they get yet less yield. Well, yes, there's a very simple relationship, and you got to think of it like a seesaw. When interest rates come down, and we're expecting this, say, with the Fed decision in September, where we're going to see a cut, probably 25 basis points, but some people are starting to say, hey, I'm going to lose out of the income that I'm making in fixed income if that happens. And I tell them, absolutely not, because when bond prices, when yields drop, bond prices go up. So it doesn't matter whether it's a T-bill, a longer-term treasury. That is just a fact. So you make money when within bonds when interest rates decline.
Yeah, it's the opposite. If they go up while you hold one, you lose on your bond. It's counterintuitive,
right,
to a lot of people.
Exactly, and if rates go up, you lose. So the thing is, it's not just the current income that you receive. It's a lot more than that. And it may be the current income if you're trying to clip a coupon like a high interest municipal bond, but the rule always applies. Lower rates, higher bond prices. Higher bond prices, higher bond prices generally are going to mean lower rates. Lower bond prices generally mean rates are going up. So that relationship is pretty static, is sort of cast in stone. So you do want to own bonds when you think rates are coming down. And if you're getting 5.5% in these T-bill strategies that we've been managing, you could get even more than that when rates come down, because you'll see an uptick in the price of your bond or your T-bill in the short run.
Correct.
So hold on to those. We're still getting like 5.35, 5.40 on 1 and 2 month T-bills. Likely that we're going to continue to see that yield even as...
Dan, you guys have had a pretty terrific year so far, haven't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the annualized return in some of these is around 7%. And also, if you look at municipal bonds, which I know, again, people think they're boring, they don't trade every day, there's some liquidity issues, there's some pricing issues, but in the end, you're getting a nice fat coupon that's tax-free, and you're going to buy an Illinois bond that also has the double tax exemption from both the state tax as well as the federal tax. So you're saving, in some cases, 30, 35%, 40% if you're at the top end of the tax range. And there were some really good quality, investment-grade quality names.
Dan, does every state do that or not all of them?
That give the double exemption?
Yeah.
Well, the states that have no state income tax, like Florida,
okay,
New Hampshire, Arizona, some of them, Nevada, some of them won't have the same benefit. They do have the benefit for AMT tax, but for the general break on state income taxes, you clearly don't have that in most of the states.
But there's no state like you know, whatever, Utah, that actually has a state income tax that, that charges tax on Utah bonds. Or
no, but there are certain bonds, though, that do not qualify, okay, whether they be industrial revenue bonds or certain projects that won't qualify. But the lion's share, the vast majority of them do. So you buy a Utah bond, and then you get the tax, you get the tax exemption on the state and the federal. And if you buy Virgin Islands bonds or Guam bonds or Puerto Rico bonds, you get the triple tax exemption in any state. So those bonds can be used in, say, New York City, if you have a New York City client who has the state and local tax as well as the federal tax. Well, instead, we're going to buy some Puerto Rico electric bonds. May not be the best example after some of the issues there yesterday, but
yeah, if your lines are down, I don't think you want those bonds.
Yeah, they got some interference from the Hurricane Ernesto, but in general, those will be triple tax exempt. So the New York City person who has Puerto Rico bonds does not have to pay local tax on them, state tax, or federal tax. So there are ways of really, you know, keeping the tax burden down. And I tell people who have, are during years where they have higher tax burdens based on the fact that may have received more income, maybe they're retiring and they got a big bonus. Those, you want to wait another year before you start looking at, you want to load up on your tax-free bonds, because those are going to really protect some of your income for that particular year, where your income is going to be high.
Dan, you were mentioning some of the commodities, and those are, I know since I had a Board of Trade badge for a while, I never went out there. We did a lot of trades there. I never went out and actually did a trade there because it included a CBOE badge. Anyway, my brother did. He traded over there for a while in the corn option pit and all those other kinds of things. But every commodity, like you mentioned, is different unto itself. It's like almost like the kung fu where the kid says, how long does it take any one of these styles? And the guy goes, a lifetime, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, corn is not the same as soybeans. It's not the same as wheat. It's not the same as oats. I mean, they're all different. And obviously our expert on that is Greg. But when you talk about the thing that is the biggest, I'll say, clunker in this mess, is what we've done to our own currency in the last several years. It's therein lies the. I mean, if you look at, and this is really hard. I know the listeners, their eyes roll back in their head when I say it, but a lot of times now we're valuing not the stock, we're valuing what we're valuing the stock in, which is dollars. And when I grew up, when you grew up, the most, you know, the most static thing there is was the buck in your pocket. It was something you could always, well, when you look at gold is a commodity unlike most, and it has some industrial use, but mostly not. Mostly it's just a store of value because, you know, it's gold, right? I actually saw this, there was a big gold exhibit at the Natural History Museum here. But all the gold that's ever been mined, Dan, what could fit in like two Olympic swimming pools or something, or one or three? I mean, it's not that much. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, it's not like there's, you know, a city full of gold. I think the part about the two pools I always thought was a little small, but anyway, I'm not the gold expert. But if let's say next year you with all the stuff going on in Colorado, going through the old entrails and stuff, if we increase the gold supply by 2%, and we increase the dollar supply by 20%. I can pretty much guarantee that in dollars, the price of gold is going to be up 18% plus or minus 2 or 3. Right? I mean, it's just an identity. It's just an identity. I mean, because one is moving faster than the other, and the fact is, the price of gold has not really, the value of gold has not gone up. The price of gold versus the dollar has gone up, because if the Swiss franc, they only put 2% of that in there, probably the price of gold in Swiss francs is the same as it was last year. And the Swiss franc is now 18% higher than the dollar. But we as Americans, Maybe we were too confident. Maybe we were too spoiled. We never thought like that, and never needed to be until the games people started to play. I mean, I know if I walked into a room where we're all having adult beverages and I said, all you idiots who think your stock market is up 40%, it really isn't. The value of the dollar in your pocket is down 40%. They would look at me like I had four heads, right? But that is pretty much the truth, right?
Yes.
Now, the problem is, if you weren't in the market, now you're skunked. Because if you just had the dollars in your pocket, you're down 40% without knowing it, or you probably do know it. And that's why it's called inflation, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's, I guess, that's the currency is, I think, a big part of this and trying to understand the full picture. One of the things, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, but just from having watched, even in just the past few weeks since Harris has stepped up, there's been a lot of what has normally been, investment and financial information on stations like CNBC, Fox Business News, Bloomberg, and then some of the other places that we source information, BBC, some of the other networks that generally will talk a little more about the economy. But even in the last few days, it was tough to hear news like that. And all I could think is that in some ways there is, the election coming up and that is taking precedence. But I think more than anything right now, we need to get a better understanding of where we are. I think we need to have more discussion on this relationship between the dollar and not only stock prices, but the impact it's having on inflation, so that people, listeners, can get a true story of what's really going on and not really be confused by all these numbers and or by all this information on particular, for example, the CPI reporting at 2.9% yesterday. On the surface, that looks really good. I mean, it's moving in the right direction. It's moving towards the goals of the Federal Reserve. But other things, as you're mentioning, Chief, and I agree with you 100%, we got to look at the whole picture, and the whole picture includes it includes currency, it includes the direction of commodities, it includes employment to the extent it means finding talented help to replace those baby boomers or those experienced people who are leaving. And that is an issue in almost all industries right now, and that issue has been accelerating. So the tech firms that have had layoffs or cut back on some of their benefits, I can already see some of the danger or some of the potential danger in having your new middle management people have very little experience when it comes to social skills or management style or really getting the full picture on how they should be managing these companies to best to deal with the environment that's approaching in the best manner. And it just seems to me a little bit confusing right now that we have some companies making decisions that don't really clearly take into account all of these factors that we've been discussing here. For example, currency, for example, the price of commodities. And that impacts every company. That impacts not only transportation companies, for example, it impacts all the tech companies, it impacts utilities, it impacts housing. So although there are some good things happening with rates coming down, we have to look at the full picture. We have to look at everything that's included and not get too excited that we truly are, that we are falling into this glorified soft landing, because it isn't going to be a glorified soft landing with a huge amount, with a large federal deficit or a wacky currency situation or layoffs at the lower level that are, or the higher level that are not in different companies that are not being replaced by people who have a level of experience, a deep level of experience, to know how to handle all of these different factors and all these different challenges that are currently taking place.
Well, You have to wonder, Dan, when you have people don't seem to want to know. I mean, I don't. Let's put it this way. I see some stuff because I have family members we talk to every week. We meet for dinner. My nephews I talk all the time is in the metals business, and they they're not, you know, they don't make steel, but they make essentially parts for custom parts for people that have big operations. I mean, if it's Tootsie Roll or something needs a part, they go to my nephew's place and say, hey, we need this stuff. We need it fast. And they're a metal servicing place, for lack of a better term, and they can make pretty much anything. Now, they're busy. The place he used to work for said if they could hire five people tomorrow, they would. And, you know, my nephew said they've been trying to find people. They managed to get a couple people out of the Army, which they were happy with. But 2 weeks ago, there was a firm that went out of business, some real small place, because I think the guy died or something. But so they were able to essentially buy the place, but that wasn't really anything about buying it. It was basically found a spot for their three good workers to come work, and maybe they had a couple of clients. But if you, in Chicago, the entire, I mean, my entire lifetime has been, the city was that was Chicago, was all that kind of manufacturing. Right. You had massive places like Pullman and places that actually made stuff, and everybody else serviced them. I mean, U.S. Steel, and there were metal stamping plants all over the damn place. People that coated stuff, people did everything. And once you lose sort of that, and now it's coming back some, you know, some. And now someday, is Trump and Biden or whoever comes after any of those two guys or Kamala, are we going to be buddies again with China and everything's going to go back over? I mean, would you commit your son or daughter to that industry? Would you, if you were 35 years old and not 70 and been your whole life in the metal business, would you buy a metal business right now just because they're busy thinking that you're going to retire from that 50 years from now and it's going to be bigger and you're going to have these employees all along the way and you're going to make money? I don't know. I mean, after what's happened in the last 50 years, can I trust it? And really?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I do think that decision-making process has changed based on so many things that have changed in our world and have changed even more, especially in very recent years, that even the way that some of these companies have been treating their employees and the way they've been trying to make money, you know, may not present a great work environment for people who are looking for a long-term career. And so that itself, I think, is a concern. Like, we talk about some of the concerns to look out for. You know, we definitely talk about the federal deficit as a concern, big picture, that could change what we're in. But I'm also concerned about this new pool of talent, or limited pool of talent, or maybe not fully trained or experienced pool of talent stepping into positions and maybe relying on AI or some other form of streamlining the entertainment they get, where it really hasn't been proven itself, and where you're talking about a morale in many of these companies, in particular the tech companies, where you've got a very different environment right now, and you have people coming into that environment who may not be prepared for this sort of change of culture, if you will, or the changes these companies are going through to just, frankly, just to survive.
Well, yeah, I think it's been the middle management group, and I think you could write a serious book on this. I mean, being in these middle-sized companies, these guys, this is going to be a way generalization, they got to be twice as smart as the owner of a big company to stay alive.
They have to be.
They don't have anywhere near the same crap from government. I mean, government largesse, a couple of them might get a contract here and there, but basically they're not. They're in the competitive world, not in the ether that everybody else seems to be in.
Yes.
And they have to, they're borrowing money at 8%, not 2% or 7% and not 3%. It's a whole different, trying to compete with these people is very difficult.
No, I agree. And the other thing that I've noticed is, you know, I was listening to a whole section on cruise ships and travel and how that, you know, that industry is, those industries are being impacted. And one of my clients actually runs a travel business for high-end travel around the world. And it's really, there are really mixed messages coming from those people, because there are certainly trips going on. There are certainly high-end people that are in that sort of top tier, if you will, or those people who have been positively impacted by inflation in their housing prices, in their 401ks, their assets, the IRAs, that have all this money, that are still traveling, that are still, you know, buying expensive yachts. And so there's a bifurcation, as we've discussed, but that particular group is still very large. And again, we've discussed that some of it's geographic and where that money's coming from. Certain places like the Northeast, Boston, California, say San Diego, LA, certain cities that still have a lot of money. And you can see that in things like prices for services, prices at restaurants, prices at grocery stores in these areas. So that's the difficult part to get your arms around. And you're trying to say what's going on in one part of the country may be different. Big picture is, though, if you look at the actual dollars that are out there that are still chasing, or still, you know, let's just look at it as retail, that are still putting money into expensive trips or into retail in general, these people have the money to do that. And so that'll continue to buoy our economy. That'll keep our economy going. So I don't see this as a all or nothing when it comes to the economic supply and demand. I still think there's going to be an extraneous something that's going to come out. It may be another cyber crash. It might be, it's something that we haven't thought about. It could relate to a war that's going to turn us in a very different direction and allow us to go into, you know, a different phase of this long-term cycle that we've been involved in, both with the economy and with the financial markets.
Yeah, and we see the market racing up here again today, and it's, you know, we're to the moon here now. Okay, we're just, every day now we're going to go straight up to the election, it looks like.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
But now, last Monday, a week ago Monday, we had the head of the Fed in Chicago, Goolsbee, that used to be the guy out in Washington, when the market was down that much, came out and said, don't worry, the Fed will save the economy. I'm going to say that you and I are not privy to this anymore, because the current administration decided to not give anybody money supply numbers on a weekly basis. I'm going to say that there was a massive injection of cash last Monday and Tuesday into the market from someplace that nobody knows about except some people, and those some people, again,
traders,
are doing very, very well. It's just like we're becoming like Mexico. And when I say that, I really believe this, Dan, because I this article the other day, I don't know if you were listening, where the one lady writes that 50%, 9% of the people think we're in a recession, and they're just wrong. We aren't. We're doing great. This idea that you can piss on people's feet and tell them it's raining, someday that's going to end. And I really hope it doesn't end violently or something, but this is way too much. This is way over the top. Whatever it is being done here. This mirror image on top of things. I don't know why I feel that way. And I obviously, for my clients, I'm long, because I think it's going to keep going for a while, you know, just as you do. So, I mean, but somehow or another, the world is not better than a week ago Friday, I don't think.
I agree.
You know, but yet the market is actually up, because, and I think we're going to find out, there was a, the injection is, I don't think anybody even, some people sort of know about it, some don't. And once it gets rolling, the market fabric is, there's nobody in the way. There's no seller anywhere. So, I mean, look at all these prices. Walmart comes out, they're up 8%. Cisco, 8%. Every time somebody talks, they paint this picture, 8, 10, 12% on earnings. And every single time, the Walmart straddle was $3. It's up 550. The market can't even understand what's going on.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, what was the MTV Money for Nothing and the Chicks for Free or something like
right.
that?
Yeah.
Can we just keep doing this, I guess? I don't know. I mean, to the point where, you know, can the market like double? Can NVIDIA, I mean, we're talking, when it was 100 and now it's 119. Man, that's 19 times 24 billion shares. That's $450 billion in market cap in 2 weeks. Switch, whether up or down. I'm going to say 10 years ago, was there even a company worth $500 billion?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, the money is like grains of sand now for some people. Other people, right. It's very dear.
Absolutely. And what I would say to you, going back to your point about currency and earlier on. But I'd also say that with the, you know, this expansion and this money coming in, what I've been telling those clients that have a lot of money or friends, take some off the top. This is the perfect environment to take some off the top. And talking to younger people, people who were, you know, in their early to mid 50s who just cashed out or got an inheritance, and, you know, they're saying that, oh yeah, I watch the market every day and the market is, you know, there's been these huge fluctuations and, you know, I thought I was going to lose a lot of money. Now I get scared. I says, listen, I will help you just by telling you, take 10% of the equity that you have and your company stock that represents, say, 20%, and lighten up on it and put it into, and I can give you ideas of some conservative investments that are still going to get you between 6 and 8% and may also save you if you have a taxable account. So this absolutely, absolutely is the time to be shifting out of the 100% equity mode and into the 70-30 or 50-50, depending on your age and your level of risk tolerance, because you've made that money already. No time to be greedy at this point. Look at your long-term goals. Look at what you want. And if you're still saving, for example, that vacation home or that trip, yeah, set some money aside in an account to do that. But with the rest of the money that you plan on living off of until retirement, start dialing back. Start taking out, you know, start selling some of those high-flying equities, and not all of it, but if you sell a little bit at a time and you catch some of those days with their rallies, you're going to do quite well. And you have to say to yourself at a certain point, how much money do I need, or does my family need, to be able to live comfortably? And I think many people are already at that point. And I don't know whether it's greed or not wanting to miss out. You have to really step back and say, this is, you know, do I need that, you know, that new, you know, that new sports car that I had when I was, you know, in my 40s? Do I need another one now in my 60s or 70s?
Well, sure. Sure, in case the other one doesn't start.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah, exactly. But I think some of those questions need to be asked. And if you want to, you know, as you get older, I think depending on whether you want to use your time to live comfortably, if you want to sleep with peace of mind, if you don't want to have to worry about the next downturn, start peeling off some of the high flyers and some of the overvalued tech stocks. And don't be so concerned about making every last penny, because you can't take it with you.
Dan, I could be perfectly happy seeing you driving along in your Lamborghini with the bumper sticker, "My vet is in the shop." just you know, I'm gonna, by the way, this 10 is
years ago.
This is I'm gonna try and make this good radio, because instead of just agreeing with you, as you know, I mean, or as everybody knows, I think I have been recommending now for a while that people, especially if you're Robin Hood or maybe Schwab that's having some issues, you should look at the Interactive Broker platform. And I think if for a professional or for a good trader, to them all bells and whistles, some of the other ones, it's probably a better platform to start out with. They pay higher interest, all that kind of good stuff. Where Dan and I have our investment advisors firms on that platform. So if ever you wanted to have Dan look at some of your fixed income or me do some of your perfected stuff, we could do it in a second. You know, so it's a way to get ahead of the game. It's not saying you have to do anything tomorrow or whatever. It's just a way of spreading yourself around, either with a couple of firms or whatever, you know. But the thing of it is, Dan, I'm gonna argue back at you, just like if you were on CNBC, what they would do to both of us. Having said that, I agree with you 100%. But this is different, Dan. They're not happy with blowing. They're so greedy. If you were to look at NVIDIA and the thing trades, again, 99 something something, and the Fed were to throw money into it, I mean, the revenue to earnings and the PE in the stock is to the moon, right? I'm not saying it's too high or whatever. I'm not saying sell it. But you would think they would be happy to get it back to 108 or 109. They're not happy. It's 119. And I think you and I could have had this discussion somewhere during the COVID when we were coming up.
Yes.
From the lower. Say, man, that thing's up 25-30% in 3 months. Maybe this is enough. Dan, it's not enough for these guys. It's not enough. They're not going to be happy till this NVIDIA is doesn't make a dime more and it's trading 250. There's no top to this thing right now. I mean, it is absolutely, and when it goes down a day, all it does is charge everybody up because the Fed throws more money into it. I don't know, other than some kind of massive crisis, what's going to turn this boat. Every one of these stocks, they think they can be, I mean, the one that I'm looking at here, and I can't even, it's not back to old highs, is CrowdStrike's been up, what, 10 days in a row? They damn near took the world down. I mean, it doesn't matter.
They damn near took the world down, exactly, yeah.
I mean, and yet people are recommending it. I mean, the lawsuits are landing on people's desks as we sit here.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter, man. There's nobody in the way. There's money coming in. Every day, there's a half a trillion dollars more in the business. It's all can be margin. That's why the Fed, if they want to actually, they're going to have to drain so much money out of the system because the borrowing coming out of the investment community is inflating the money supply every single day on its own.
I mean,
the money supply is going up with the Fed balance sheet rocketing down. I mean, where's that money coming from? It's being created in the financial sector, isn't it?
It is. It's being right. It's being created by this the valuation. It's being created as this snowball is going downhill and it's getting or going uphill and it's collecting more and more. It's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense that as more money chases it, prices are going to go higher. And it actually, as far as I'm concerned, is a piece of inflation that's not discussed very much.
Oh, sure.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's part of what I think that the naivety or sort of the lack of understanding the full picture is all about. And also now we have more people than we ever have who have stepped out that are working either full-time or part-time. Even just going to the gym, I must have a dozen guys come over, and they don't all totally understand what I do, but in many cases, they volunteer their information on their 401k. And, Chief, at this point, they're saying, oh, well, like, you know, the other day when the market was down, oh, I think I'm going to lose all my money. And I said, look, I'll give you a really simple, without asking you to take a look at your account, I'll give you a very simple rule of thumb. Sell 10% of it. And put it into T-bills. Sell 10% of it and put it into a protected strategy. Take some of it off the table that you've worked so hard to earn and sleep easier at night. It really is, it's, you know, at this stage where they have the level of money that will keep them for, you know, another century, don't be worried about picking at little pieces. Don't be worried about, you know, being overly concerned about, you know, one day sell off in the market. Another situation is a client who was very concerned about less than 1% of her portfolio that had lost a tiny bit of money, where she earned hundreds of thousands of dollars this year and 99% of her portfolio, when she kept focusing on that small tiny loss she had. And I had to tell her that that's not really, you know, you really have to look at what you have. And she's talking about not being able to sleep at night because she lost a few hundred dollars in a small IRA. I said, you've made a few hundred thousand dollars this year in your larger IRA and your trust account. And, you know, there's no need to be focused on the small piece that's losing when the big piece. And again, that goes to looking at the big picture, stepping back and looking at what you have. And being realistic about how you want to live in retirement. And sure, people want to travel, they want to take cruises, they want to take trips, they want to buy a second home. All of that makes sense to me when you're saving for that and you can have a plan for that. But when you're just trying to make more money for the sake of making more money and not understanding the potential consequences that could come at a time where you may not be ready for them when you're not working and have less income, doesn't make sense. So
then
you have time
the same
lighten up.
You have the same issue at trying to talk. And you know, again, it's what I think people should be doing and should be using you, especially after days like today, should be looking to have us help them out for sure. But it's the exact same in 1982, early in the year.
Yes.
It was obvious to me the market had to go up because interest rates were coming down. You could not get anybody to put a dime in the market when they were making. And now you can't, this has been the game for the last however many years, just be in the market. You can't get, here's a little something for you, you'll appreciate this. I call it panic, too afraid to sell at a price less than additional profit be lost. The panic which keeps people at roulette tables is the insidious propaganda against quitting a winner, the fear of being taunted by those who held on, all worked together. It became not only a point of pride, but of civic duty not to sell as if there was ever a buyer or a seller. Congressional testimony after the crash of 29. People don't change, do they?
Perfect.
People don't. It's, you know, and how many people last week said be worried about the market? Every single one said you have to, this is a buy the dip. If you don't get in, if you get out, you're crazy. If you don't buy in, you're nuts. And you know what? They're right again, Dan. They're right again. 10% in 8 days.
Right. But the quote is perfect.
Yep.
And I think that's, you know, really where people need to stay focused. There's, you know, one of the other areas that's, it's all related is, you know, people ask, so what do? You're holding bonds and interest rates go down. We know the Fed's going to cut. And I'll repeat this, that bonds do well. So as interest rates go down, bonds go up. So it doesn't matter whether you own treasury bond or T-bill or a muni bond, municipal bond, or a corporate bond. Bond prices go up when interest rates go down. So as that happens, which it's just starting to happen now, you do want to be in corporate bonds because the spreads are going to widen. You're going to get more yield. You do want to be in municipal bonds. Municipal bonds have their own yield curve. It doesn't track the yield curve of the treasuries. So there's an inefficiency in the municipal bond market, yet there's a lot of value there. And we don't see municipal bonds defaulting, nor do we expect to see any major defaults in that sector. What you do get with the municipal bonds is the risk of illiquidity. So they're buy and hold, they're clip your coupon, get your tax-free income, and have a nice AA rated bond with a nice tax advantage, giving you about 7%, which is pretty good. Not bad right now. You have to have somebody like me managing it because you won't get that price on your own, and we will look and trade it as necessary. We'll look at it every day. So those are the type of vehicles that you can be in the bond market when interest rates are going down and make money.
Dan, do you see any risk in some of the cities that have had, I mean, obviously I'm in a city here that is wobbling. Hopefully it's not going to wobble too much this convention next week, but boy, I don't know.
Right.
We have received and totally mismanaged all the money that came from the federal government for COVID. I mean, the last 6 months, the mayor has been running out there trying to find people to give away, you know, the last COVID, you know, his buddies to give it away to, you know, and so that drip from the federal government is I think shot or is getting shot. Is there going to be a big rewriting of the ratings of Chicago and the cities that basically took that money, made things look good for a while, and now they're back in the, I don't think they're back in the same trap. I think they actually are probably stronger than they were because of the money they got. But I mean, we just lost another 80,000 people in Chicago. I mean, the trend is not there. I mean, at some point do you want to say you want to avoid these 10 cities? I mean, I don't know if I was, I would think the reason why I would want to use somebody like you is you might find a Tulsa, Oklahoma that's swimming in cash and, you know, put your money there, don't put it here or someplace.
Yeah, and it all gets on how, it's all about how it's priced, right? So if Chicago, say, gets to a triple B rating, you know, lower than the single A or double A rating, but yet it's priced really cheaply and you know that they're going to be bailed out if something happens and it's a short-term bond and it's a general obligation bond or if it's a revenue bond for a particular project like an airport expansion or something like that, that would actually have you know, a good steady flow of funds, or it has a sinking fund that's been set aside to pay off the interest and principal as it comes due. So that's why we have to look at each circumstance. So there could definitely be some good opportunities, even with the lower rated, or even with the Chicago bonds that might be under pressure. The one thing I will say is that the rating agencies who rate these bonds always lag, so they do not anticipate, oh, in the future we're going to see that they're going to have a tough time making their principal and interest payments, so we're lowering their ratings. What they do is they wait until the bad news is out, and they make their decisions long after the bad news has happened and the price has already declined. Our job is to anticipate these decisions
and what,
to make our own ratings based on.
Well, that's why they pay you. But My question is, well, I have a question. I have a million questions going to be around because you know more about this area. It's always fascinating to me. If you have a airport revenue bond, now O'Hare's pretty damn busy, and all of a sudden you had a COVID thing for a year or two. It was like two almost, right? Maybe a little more than two. And all of a sudden, you know, there's not a whole lot of flights, or at least there wasn't for a while. So the landing fees, all that kind of stuff, they're not getting them if you're not landing, right? I mean, it's obvious. Plus, nobody's there, you know, drinking beer in the bars at ridiculous prices where they get, whatever, 20% of the gross.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
So how far down the pecking order does the bad times have to get before that interest payment is missed? Is that like they'll lay everybody else off? What has to happen to get down there?
Generally, it would have to some of what would have to happen in that circumstance is there has to be some cost issue. For example, not able to get costs down, you know, like on the cost side of the equation. It's not so much on the revenue side, because you have a steady stream of revenue coming in, unless suddenly people stop flying, or unless the funding that they've received is dried up. But that's unlikely. More likely is on the cost side.
Okay, start since you brought that up. Start from the top. Since I don't know, where do the airports get most of their money from? I would have said somehow through concessions and landing fees, but is it ticket price? I have no idea. What is it?
Yeah, each airport is a little different, and some of them are tied in with the city, so they could be, you know, the airport is considered a revenue bond and not a general obligation bond, so they don't get their money from the tax paying, you know, the tax ability to tax Chicago residents, for example. They get their money from other funding sources that could be money that's been set aside for, say, an expansion of the airport, adding another runway. And some of that money could come from the government. Some of it would have to come from the government in order to fund or be able to fund the final project. But oftentimes, Chief, it comes from other sources. So that could be some of the airlines themselves that are going to get, you know, that have to pay to get a particular gate or a certain number of gates, say they're expanding the number of gates, or it's paid by the authority. So I know in Boston, when they were expanding Massport as the authority that was expanding Logan Airport, and so they were considered an agency that was responsible for the expansion, but they were also a funding source. So whether it be the vendors who come in, as you mentioned, that are going to be selling whatever, donuts or whatever they're selling, or the people who are getting fees, some sort of royalties or fees on the jetways from United or American or the other airlines. So there's a combination of sources of revenue that come in and a part of the ticket fee that each ticket holder will pay. So there are sources of revenue that are not necessarily going to dry up. The thing, however, as I mentioned, the cost of some of the of this expansion may be higher than what was originally planned, and that could be based on contractor prices increasing. That could be based on, you know, in the past it was based on supply and demand issues. That is probably, we're probably in better shape there today than we have been. But there's a number of sources that are going to fund the expansion, and then there's going to be a number of potential obstacles in terms of those costs of funding the expansion being more, causing more challenges than were originally planned.
All right,
unlikely for them to go bankrupt. Very, very unlikely, because those sources of revenue will continue to step up.
Well, yeah, I think you're probably real solid on something like that. I was just curious as to. Is that who gets paid what first? And it sounds like, you know, that they're...
Yeah, that's, again, part of our job is to look at the indenture and see who does get paid first on which particular bonds are issued. Because the difference between municipal bonds and, say, corporates and treasuries is that with municipals, you may have, $1 million project, but it's split into $1 million funding, let's say, but it's split into 10 different $100,000 bond issues, and each bond issue may have, some bonds may actually be backed by the actual aircraft, so they'd be secured. Some bonds may have more funding from one of the government agencies, the transportation agency, whether it be local or federal, depending on the arrangement they have or what particular part of the project they're working on. Some of them may be funded by, you know, the tickets themselves or a portion of the tickets themselves that are, might have to do with adding a runway or expanding the jetways or making the, you know,
Dan, we got a dash, bud. We'll talk next week, if not sooner. Have a nice weekend. No hurricanes coming your way. You're sending this one to Bermuda, eh?
No. We're in good shape right now, and just dealing with the heat and trying to stay cool.
Well, the people in Bermuda are not happy you sent them a hurricane.
Yeah, no, Puerto Rico.
It's heading up to Bermuda now.
In Bermuda, yeah. The electric, Puerto Rico Electric, was a bond that we owned for a period of time, and more than half of the establishments in Puerto Rico lost power. Those, you know, hopefully short term, and they've been through this before. It's a part of the issue of
being. All right, bud. Well, we'll talk next. SP Futures up 50. SP Futures up 222. Let's ride this horse and enjoy, eh?
Absolutely.
We'll be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.